This is Poetry Off the Shelf. I'm Helena de Groot. Today, Patterns of Memory. Please know that this week's episode contains mentions of violence, so this one may not be for all listeners. Okay, here's the show. When Natasha Trethewey was 19, her mother, Gwendolyn, was murdered by her abusive husband, Joel, Natasha's stepfather. 35 years later, Natasha Trethewey published a memoir, Memorial Drive, named after the street in Atlanta, Georgia, where it happened. It took her 7 years to write, and the hardest part was having to revisit moments she tried her whole life to forget. And her memory would play tricks on her, too, bringing back the same images over and over. A birthmark on her mother's neck, for instance, or an old photo with a funny glow. Images that, today, seem to read like early warning signs, if only she had known their secret language then. When I sat down with Natasha Trethewey in early May, I asked her if she could start by reading an excerpt from Memorial Drive. In this excerpt, she's 6 years old. Nothing bad has happened yet. Well, that's not true, but it's long before her mother would meet this new man. But what has happened is that her parents have split up, and Natasha and her mother have made a traumatic move from grandma's house in Gulfport, Mississippi, which Natasha knows inside and out, to this new, unfamiliar apartment in Atlanta, Georgia.
The two-story apartment seemed huge and empty. On the ground floor, behind the long stairway, was a hollow space that, at night, looked like the entrance to a cave. It was enough to heighten the childhood fears I'd begun to cultivate before we left Mississippi, fears that always involved some frightening figure that might emerge from the shadows. My friend Dee Dee and I had been afraid to look too long into the recesses of my grandmother's deep closet, so we had entertained ourselves by telling stories about what lurked there. She would recount how the devil took people to hell, how the ground would open and he'd pull you in by your ankles, or how you might go through a door you weren't supposed to and find yourself there. We played Bloody Mary, too, closing the blackout shades to make the room dark as night in the middle of the day. Standing before a mirror, we'd take turns trying to summon her, saying her name 3 times so that she would appear reflected in the glass. We'd have barely uttered the last syllable before one of us would call for St. Christopher to protect us, the other yanking open the shades and flooding the room with light to banish whatever it was we had summoned. Now, away from the safety of my grandmother's house, I could not so easily banish what frightened me. If I had to go to the bathroom at night, I'd keep my eyes closed so that I would not see the mirror on my mother's dresser in the dark, afraid of what I'd find there. Nor would I go down to the kitchen for a glass of water, fearing that I might see what lurked in that space beneath the stairs. My mother was determined to help me adjust to our lives in this new place, to be happy. One afternoon, she had the idea of decorating the space beneath the stairs to make a playroom for me. Instead of trying to brighten it, we would make use of the darkness, like the night mind at work, a place of dreams, creative and fertile. We made stars from cardboard and aluminum foil, planets out of styrofoam balls flecked with glitter to catch even the smallest amount of light. Above the doorway, she hung a sign, Natasha's room beneath the stars. I had a small table and chair, a lamp, and a shelf that held my books and all of my sacred objects. A thimble, a pair of wooden spools, the hand-painted silk fan my grandmother had used in church. The morning we left Mississippi, she'd put them all in one of Uncle Son's old cigar boxes. "You're an easy child to love," she'd said, drawing me close to her and wiping my face of tears.
Thank you. I love this passage so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, your mother's so alive in your book.
Yeah.
You know, the way she loves and sees you.
Yeah,
but also just for who she is herself, you know, even in her life before you, like her personality and, you know, her wit, her heart.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering what that was like for you writing that, to focus on, you know, not her death, but her life.
Well, you know, I was just thinking about how vivid the memories of that time and place are to me. I think it has something to do with trying to rehearse memory of the things that we want to keep, that we don't want to lose. And even as I don't think I quite realized that I needed to be holding on to those things, instead I was thinking more of holding on to what I was leaving behind in Mississippi. Those days with both my parents and with my grandmother and extended family there. These images of my mother from that first year in Atlanta, particularly when it was just the two of us, are just seared into my memory. And I found that writing them seemed to bring her back momentarily. Even as I thought I had forgotten so much, writing it brought it back.
And can you tell me how that happened? Was it really in the process of writing, or was it later? You were cooking something and all of a sudden there she was, or was it at night when you were dreaming?
Oh, you know, it's a little bit of all of those. In the writing, I can remember a day sitting down to write about being in New Orleans with her and going downtown to shop. And I hadn't thought about or remembered for years the names of these particular department stores that were just in New Orleans. And as I was writing, the next thing I knew, I heard myself saying D.H. Holmes, Godshaw's, Maison Blanche. And with that came back all these other memories of riding the streetcar. And then there are moments where something in one of my own gestures will bring her back. Just yesterday, I was walking down the stairs and I caught a glimpse of my hand on the rail, and it was her hand.
Yeah. How did you manage to write your mother in such a way that I could see her move? Of course I can't, but you gave me the impression that I could.
You know, I think that's a hard question. I'm trying to think about it and to pinpoint it. I think that I see her gesturally. And I think about the way that, you know, gestures are the hardest to fake. When they reveal us, they reveal us deeply.
That is so true.
And I think I paid attention a lot to her gestures and how much they communicated to me. And ultimately, if you write about a gesture, then you're making an image of it.
Yeah.
And I had to, I think growing up in that house, once she remarried, glean everything I could through gesture, because there were so many silences, necessary silences.
Yeah. Right. So you started really paying attention.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's cool this a little bit, because I don't want you to immediately be stuck in this. I just want to talk about writing and especially the editing process, because one of the things that I thought was so remarkable about this book is how compact it is, even though you cover a lot of ground. And so I'm wondering, how did you go about compressing it? Like, how did you have the distance to see, okay, I can cut this, I don't need that? And was there someone else involved in that process? And how was that?
You know, when you first said, how compact it is. I thought that was a kind way of saying short.
But I don't know if it's short, because then I looked at the page count and I was like, oh, it is 210 pages. You know, it felt the way a poem does, where like the poem may be short in word count, but the effect inside you is humongous, you know?
Well, I did think of it like a poem, like a long poem. And things that I've learned from writing poetry guided me in this too. You know, there's a story that I'm telling, a through line of story, that the events are not presented in a linear narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But I did not write a lot of things that didn't make it in. At some point, I knew that I wanted those interludes, those small kind of meta pieces that fit in between various chapters. And I knew that I never wanted it to unfold as if it were leading up to the death, her murder, as if that were the story. And so it was necessary that that was established immediately. And I wanted a reader to move through the story I was telling, wishing at every turn that she survived, even though, you know, she didn't.
Yeah. And you were really successful. I mean, there are all these anecdotes about various places and things and memories and all these things that are not, not goal-oriented, right? It's not like, oh, we're going to this end. Like, this could be a story about anything. Of course, you already knew what it was about because you start the book with this dream. 3 weeks after my mother is dead, I dream of her. So we know that much. But like in the beginning, I still felt like, oh, there's all of these different paths that we could take.
Uh-huh.
And then as the book progressed, those paths got cut off. And then there's no more escaping that thing at the end, you know?
Yeah.
It felt like that. Like it took a while for that inevitability to set in.
Uh-huh.
And then when it did, you were like, I mean, or I was at least sort of digging my heels in the whole time.
Yeah.
But I was so grateful that you started with this wide open space, you know, this space where there was no threat. There was nothing inevitable about it.
Right. And even as it could certainly have seemed that way then, you know, every detail, every little place or little story I tell is still ultimately supposed to, at some point, show that we were headed there all along. I mean, if you think about all the other details I might have told,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I kept thinking about being in New Orleans, you know, when I told you that I began to remember things in writing about going downtown in the streetcar.
Uh-huh.
And one of those things was riding with my mother one day and, you know, the streetcar had metal framed windows and I was riding with my fingers hooked over the little windowsill and my mother didn't see that my hand was there and she wanted to lower the window and so lowered it onto one of my fingers. And for the longest time, I had a scar there.
Mm-hmm.
That isn't there anymore, but and I think I was on my way to get my ears pierced.
So there are all kinds of signs on your body from that day, markings.
Yeah, and you would think that, you know, given that I'm concerned with being marked from the very beginning, because I talk about a birthmark, that I might have chosen those details, but mm-hmm. they're not the ones that I chose.
But that is, I'm so glad that you say this, because this was a paradox that I was trying to put in words, you know, like on the one hand, there was this sense of like, no, this is not inevitable.
Right.
But at the same time, as you say about that birthmark, I mean, there were so many other things, like, you know, dreams, or the way light spots on an old picture seem to foreshadow something that's going to happen, not in a logical way.
Right.
But in the way
none of it had to happen. Right.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so I was wondering how do you square these two between not inevitable, like your life could have gone any way,
right,
and this was predestined?
Yeah, it is like I wanted to lay the two opposite possibilities on top of each other, you know. One, the literal inevitability, because we know what happened already. It's going to go there. That is the fact of what happened. But at every turn, there's myriad potential for other things to have happened, for interventions to have happened along the way, for chance even to, you know, set us on a slightly different path, so that all those things could have just as easily added up to a very different outcome. And I often thought about it as like constellations in the sky, you know, before the ancients decided to draw a particular line in the sky that connected the stars a certain way and made certain shapes, there were myriad other shapes you might have made.
Yeah, I never thought about that before. Because you're right. Like, we're so used to these shapes, the ones that people came up with.
Yeah, they were told to see. And I remember my father, you know, showing me the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper. And I remember how long it took me to actually see it, because I was connecting, or my eyes were making other patterns and not the pattern I was being told to look at.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So do you, when you go back to these early memories and you have, for instance, that moment in the pool, you know, still in Gulfport, Mississippi, and you almost drown in a pool and your mom saves you. And while you're under the water, you look up at her and she has like a halo, you know, because mm-hmm. the sun is behind her. So what do you make of the fact that there too, like, there seems to be this possible foreshadowing,
yeah,
that she would have to pass on to the next world?
Well, you know, with that particular memory, the image was so striking to me as a child that I would look at it in my head frequently. I continued to see it, to carry that image with me. I don't know why, other than that it was perhaps traumatic in a way. I mean, I don't think of it as a traumatic moment, but of course I was sinking and not swimming. And so, so I suppose that, you know, my body might have known something about the trauma of it mm-hmm. and recorded that image. But the interpretation of it is what comes later. Poet Mark Doty says our metaphors go on ahead of us. Mm. And we get to them by describing the images that we see and making comparisons. And so I always saw the sun behind her, the way that her head, her face blocked it. But it wasn't until much later that I began to see that as, you know, the way that we see religious figures represented in art with that corona of light.
Yeah.
I just saw it for what it was, and later on I began to have a different vocabulary to describe it. Hmm. And I think, how would I be describing it? What vocabulary for what I saw would I be using if the outcome were different.
Right.
But I also think, I'm thinking about just the trying to make sense of, you know, why I was attuned to certain kinds of images. Because, you know, that circle, that sun, that shape of her afro, like, why does that stay with me? Why do any of these things stay with us until all of a sudden we connect them into some constellation of a story of our lives?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay, I understand. I think I better understand what those signs mean. Yeah, that those signs do not point to the inevitable. We give them the read later based on what happened.
Yeah. We make meaning of them looking backwards. That's when we draw the constellation.
Don't want to assume anything, but I can imagine that something that happens is gradually as domestic abuse, that it's very hard to remember that in discrete moments that you can write about, you know, like the first time that you heard, you know, Joel hit your mother, or even the first time you met him, you know. Mm-hmm. Did you struggle remembering those things?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I very clearly remember meeting him for the first time, and also very clearly remember hearing for the first time him hit her. What I do not recall is anything else. I do not recall hearing any other moments like that. And obviously, they must have happened. And yet, somehow, I do not have them. I do not remember them. And I've often wondered what that was about. Was it that it was always, you know, kept secret behind a door? Because the only time the time I remember hearing it, I wasn't in my own room. I was in my brother's room, which mm-hmm. was right next to their room. So did I not hear it because my room was far enough down the hall and that's where I always was and not in my brother's room mm-hmm. other than that night? Or is it something that my brain has worked to banish? Mm. Yeah.
Did you talk about it with your brother? Does he remember?
I don't think he remembers any of that either.
Hmm. And what do you remember about meeting him for that first time?
I remember being wary of him from the first moment I met him. Seeing something in him that didn't seem quite right. Something unsettling. And, you know, I sort of assumed that it was those gestures, a look, a gesture, I don't know, perhaps a slight tone in the voice, or just a kind of intuition that children have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's something that that struck me was how restrained you were in writing about him. As you say, you know, when you first meet him, you don't say, oh, I immediately disliked him. You know, you just describe the way he kind of grins, you know, and that his one eye is slightly bigger than the other.
Yeah.
But you immediately know, you know. And I was thinking about that when I remembered something that a writer teacher once said to us in class. She said, you can't write well about someone you hate because hatred flattens them.
Right.
And so I wonder how you approached writing about him.
You know, I believe very much in the power of restorative justice. And because of that, whenever I thought about him, I just remembered that he was a child once, that he was born an innocent, like all children, and that whatever had disfigured him so much, that he could do something like this, was something that had happened to him. And so I could extend a kind of empathy for the innocent, the child he was before something so disfigured him.
Yeah. Is that something that you, that took you a long time before you could do that?
No.
That's remarkable.
I mean, I didn't want to see him, but, you know, when I was a little girl and sort of figuring out what my early commitments were to justice, I was very concerned about the rights of incarcerated people. Mm. Because, you know, you would see a movie or you'd watch TV or you'd hear people who would make jokes about people going to prison and what would happen to them there. And the jokes were always about abuse, sexual abuse, violation, as if that were somehow part of it, that if you committed a crime and your punishment was prison, prison also meant dehumanization, abuse, yeah. You know, and that's wrong. That's not what the bargain is. Yes, you have to give up freedom to be out here with the rest of us, but never the innate rights of human beings to dignity and not being victimized, not being abused. I've always felt that way. Mm-hmm. Even for someone who did what he did. His punishment is prison. It's not any other kind of mistreatment.
Yeah, it's remarkable how strong it is in the book that you do humanize him. Yeah, and there are these little details, like, you know, the fact that he was ashamed of what his toes looked like,
yeah.
And that he would just blame Vietnam, but that you were pretty sure that that was not what it was,
right.
Or that he would sing along to the radio, and that he was terrible at singing,
right.
But you could tell that he was trying, you know, that he actually thought of himself maybe as an artist even.
Yeah.
The one that really got me was when he took like a kind of drawing.
Yeah, when he was trying to draw. that wounded me to see, you know, mm-hmm. his failed attempts at drawing the most basic cartoon character.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I could see in it was a human need to be able to do something and his inability to do it. And I could imagine what that would feel like.
Yeah. 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 I mean, that was really a testament to your, how capacious you are as a human being. You know, I was really blown away by it. I don't think I could have.
Well, you know, I feel like, you know, there's that scene in Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye,
mm-hmm.
in which you begin to understand. You see the moment that Charlie Breedlove looks at Piccola and does what he does.
Yeah.
And before you get there, Morrison shows you all the things that have disfigured Charlie Breedlove, mm-hmm. all the things that could get him to that moment. So he's not simply a monster.
Yeah. I mean, you do also include the monster. And
and
what struck me was that the most monstrous part of this entire book is not something you wrote.
Yeah.
It's actually just the transcripts of the final phone calls between your mother and Joel and your mother.
Yeah.
Taped those calls. Can you tell me a little bit about those calls, why your mother taped them and why you decided to include those transcripts?
Yeah. Well, in order to get an arrest warrant, because of the threats that he was making, my mother had to have evidence. They wouldn't simply take her word for it. And so she needed evidence of him making terroristic threats. And so someone from the DA's office came and helped her set up a tape recorder attached to her phone so that she could take his calls and record them. And so she records 2 days worth of conversations in which he is giving her an ultimatum, among other things, you know, going back and forth between telling her how happy she'll be with him if she just gives it a shot, to here's your choice, come back to me or you die.
Yeah, and he keeps coming back to it too, right? I mean, it's like a loop from hell, you know?
Right,
I mean, she always sort of talks her way out of it and says, that's not a choice.
Yeah.
And then he keeps just pulling her back in like, oh, yes, it is. You know, you can either come back to me or I'll kill you.
I mean, would you believe there was so much more than that?
Oh.
That I actually had to edit out. I mean, it was overwhelming. It was so much. There was probably would have been 30 more pages.
Oh, God. And you edited that?
Actually, that's the one part that I couldn't do.
Yeah.
My agent did that. He used to be an editor, and he's very good. And Rob McQuilkin. And the problem was, even now, even when I had to read the proofs and, you know, go through it, I never wanted to have to read those again. I don't even want to read. There could be all kind of mistakes. I mean, I know that they're not, but I was I got to a point where there could be a lot of mistakes, but I can't read this again. So when he did the initial like cutting of big chunks of it, you know, then I went back and I could go through it then, but I was not the one who could sort of decide about that. It was, but yes, I mean, there was probably 30 more pages. The loop was so insistent and difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, it's frightening.
But I knew that they had to be there. Because I wanted him to speak for himself. I wanted you to see. But more than that, I wanted you to see her. I wanted you to see my mother and how amazingly resilient and calm and determined she was.
Yeah.
In spite of that, to hear it in her own words.
Yeah. Yeah, she does. She keeps calmly centering him, right? Like centering
so
the conversation.
Yeah.
She is. Unbelievable. Yeah. Yeah, and to know that it's even much longer than what you printed in the book, it was a struggle to read, you know. I can't imagine what it must have been like for her.
And, you know, I recorded the audio book of that.
Oh, God.
Yeah, Natasha, so I actually did, you know, I recorded the audio book.
And so you had to read both parts?
Yeah, I did. But that was actually my decision. The publisher would have hired actors, you know, to do it. But I could not let that go.
And tell me why you decided ultimately to do it yourself.
Because I worried about how they would be dramatized.
Yeah.
I didn't want the very real possibility of someone's stereotypical ideas about who these people were to affect how they played them, how they voiced them. I wanted it to actually sound like not the moment that it was happening, but the transcript of it used in court.
Uh-huh.
Like the way a stenographer sitting there, you know, taking down everything that is said and then asked to read it back.
Here's Natasha reading an excerpt from one of these transcripts. The phone call happened on June 3rd, 1985, 2 days before Joel Grimet murdered Natasha's mother. At this point in the conversation, he's already told her multiple times that he'll kill her if she doesn't come back to him. Natasha's mother, Gwendolyn, or G, speaks first.
G, have you thought about how your hurting me would affect the children? J, yes, I have. G, and that doesn't matter to you? J, yes, it matters to me. It means a lot to me about how, but they'll have to accept it, just like when your mother dies. You won't want to accept it, but you'll have to accept it because you know that we're not put here on earth to last forever. G. Joel, you can't correlate those things. You know, natural death is one thing. That's not what you're talking about. J. But I've died one time already for you. G. I'm not sure I understand what that means. J. When you divorced me, I died inside. G. Oh, come on, Joel. We're talking about leaving this earth. Now stop being whatever you're being. We're talking about the kid's mother dying a natural death versus you killing me. Now how can you correlate those two things? J. What I'm saying is that eventually they will get over it. It will probably be with them the rest of their lives, but I think they will adjust to it. They will have to. And then, if they don't, you could be as much to blame as I would be. G. Why? J. Because it didn't have to be that way. G. And you really think that any two people, any two rational adults, can even start a relationship or try to start a relationship on this basis? J. At this point, well, we don't have a choice. G. We?
I was wondering why ultimately you decided to to include it like that in full, I mean, not in full because you said it would be 30 pages more, but at length, you know, at some length. Why did you do that?
Yeah, I think it, you know, beyond, you know, the need for her voice to be heard and for what was monstrous about him to be revealed in his own words, I'm very drawn to documentary evidence. And, you know, I feel like if I had tried to write that, to tell the story about that call, it might have had more of a potential to be dismissed in a way by a reader as subjective on my part.
Yeah.
And so I didn't want to offer anything subjective. I wanted to offer the documentary evidence that was, you know, used in a court of law, so that the only subjective opinion about it would be the reader's. Mm-hmm. What are you going to make with the evidence you've just been shown? I mean, even I think the when I do finally come back at the very end of that with two short paragraphs, they are also meant to be just the fact of what occurred when the arrest warrant was issued.
Yeah.
That a police officer left, that he arrived, and then what the autopsy recorded.
Yeah.
But of course I don't leave it until I mention that birthmark that she had that you mm-hmm. first learn about in the first chapter.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, when you read where the bullet hit and it lodged near the base of her skull, behind the blood-red bloom of her birthmark. Yeah, that initial mention about the birthmark, you get this, the pull of, yeah, inevitability.
Yeah, like a bit fate.
Yeah, yes, yeah, yeah. And I wanted to ask you about fate in this, you know, because, yeah, we've talked about it earlier, and you have complicated it for me, you know, so I know that you're not like a strict believer that this is all written
right.
in the stars or anything, you know. But then there's this story near the end of the book of a stranger who approached you when you and her husband went out for dinner one night in Decatur. And I was wondering if you can tell me that story and how you see fatedness.
Yeah. Well, so I had been away from Atlanta for a long time, but I finally moved back there to take a job at Emory University in 2001. And Emory happens to be in DeKalb County, which is where all of this took place. And the seat of DeKalb County government, the little town, is Decatur. It's where I grew up. And so, you know, you might think there are a lot of places I could have chosen to live, but if you're thinking that I'm just choosing the proximity of being near my job, then that's why I moved to Decatur.
Yeah.
So one day, my husband and I were walking from our home to downtown Decatur, where there's a restaurant that we like to go to on the square. And a man came up to our table. We were sitting in the bar area and said, "Did I just see y'all walking from the Holiday Inn?" which is the sort of little hotel convention center in downtown Decatur. Mm-hmm. And I said no to him. And then he said, "Oh, I'm sorry to have bothered you." And he went and sat down. And then a few minutes later, the bartender came around with a round of drinks that the man had sent. And his apologies again for having bothered us. Well, you know, that I think that seemed a little odd that, you know, no big deal. It happened. But then send around him drinks. So I thought, well, let me just go over and say thank you. And I went over to the table where he was sitting with a woman who I learned was his wife, and made small talk, and which is sort of like, well, you know, what do you do? What do you do? And I told him what I did, and then he told me what he did. And he was an assistant DA in Rockdale County. And I could see the DeKalb County Courthouse out the window. And so I, again, I think making small talk, really, I said, oh, well, I know somebody that used to be the DA for DeKalb County. And he said, well, how did you know J. Tom? And I said, oh, well, there was this case. And that's when he said, was Gwen Grimmett your mother and Joey your brother? And, you know, I was stunned that he knew that. And I kind of looked at his wife and I looked back at him, and tears were welling up in his eyes. And I looked back at her again, and she said, not a day goes by that he doesn't think about your mother. And it turns out that he had been the first police officer on the scene the morning she was killed. So we sort of struck up a friendship then, and he told me that they were, after 20 years, they purged the records of cases from the courthouse. And it was 20 years, and it was 2005, and they were going to be purging my mother's case records. So he rescued them for me. And we met downtown again, and he gave them to me with a bottle of wine and said, you're going to need it.
Yeah. And what did it do for you to know that this man who's just doing his job has thought about your mother for 20 years?
Well, it just reminds me yet again how moved people were by her and her story, even back then.
Yeah.
That it should not have happened. But that no one was able to prevent it.
Yeah.
It was certainly serendipity, chance, that I ran into him, that he saw me. You know, Louis Pasteur said, chance favors the prepared mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, clearly even as I was trying to avoid all this, I did put myself in certain proximities. Mm-hmm. So that if it was going to happen, I mean, it would be, it's less likely a chance that I would, you know, be on vacation in Florida and run into
yeah,
him,
sure,
right?
Sure. Yep, yep, yeah, yeah.
But you put yourself in the place where and that seems almost a kind of subconscious intentionality.
Yeah, exactly. Helping fate along just a little bit.
Yep.
Yeah. But that is such a tricky one, right? Do we torture ourselves thinking that there is a plan, you know, all the awful things being part of it, or do we just live in the chaos of no plan?
Right. I mean, I don't like chaos. I prefer to see meaning and pattern, which is what it means to look back and to find a recognizable pattern that can give meaning and also purpose for what I continue to do. I mean, this has been with me since my father named me in his fiction Cassandra.
Yeah.
I mean, carrying that notion of clairvoyance, foresight.
Mm-hmm.
When really, it probably has a lot more to do with something else I said, and that is reading so closely the signs, the gestures, those signs, not the spots in photographs or something like that, but actual gestures that do carry meaning and warn us of danger and can help us be safe if we pay attention.
Right. Yeah, that, I mean, partly it already answers this question that I had, but I'm still going to ask you because I'd like to have the other parts too. Very, very early on in the book, you write, "I need now to make sense of our history." And so I was wondering what making sense has come to mean to you.
I think it is about finding the pattern. And on a very basic level, that means making sense rather than allowing something to remain senseless. So if I just allow the chaos of this to remain senseless, my mother, it was a senseless murder, you know, that phrase that people use.
Yeah.
I can't live with just that. I need to make sense of it. And it makes sense. It makes the most sense for me in terms of my calling. Being here in this moment, answering my mother's life with mine, that gives meaning and purpose rather than leaving all of that as just a senseless thing that never should have happened.
Yeah. And I couldn't help but think, even though I don't believe in those things, that when you had a fire at your house in Chicago, that melted your husband's computer and destroyed much else of the house, but your handwritten manuscript of your memoir was almost untouched, just a few pages destroyed. I couldn't help but think that was your mother, you know?
Yeah.
Would you have rewritten it had it been destroyed?
Oh. You know, I can only answer that by thinking in the most practical sense that I was required to write it. Let's just start there, and then I'll move away from that. You know, contractually, so.
yep. Right, that's true. I forgot about the real world for a second.
but I think your question means something else. Would I have written a different story? I think that I could have spent who knows how many years writing this book. I could have continued. Something had to stop me and make me finish it and make me tell the story that there was to tell. So I suppose that I could have bought myself a lot more time by even pretending that all was lost. You know, you tell your publisher, well, you know, guess what?
Yeah, dog ate my homework, but
exactly. The dog ate my homework. I'm going to need an extension.
Yeah.
But the point is, I think there was a part of me at the very beginning that wanted to write about my mother as if I were her biographer rather than her daughter writing a memoir.
Yeah.
That's the book I could have spent, you know, forever writing. But a daughter's memoir was a different thing.
I'm so glad you wrote the book you did.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I think at this point I am too, you know. You know, like, I didn't enjoy writing it, but I enjoy having written it.
Yeah. I'm so grateful that you did. Yeah. And that you talk to the likes of me about it, you know? I can't imagine that that's easy. So.
Oh, gosh. This has actually been really wonderful. Because, you know, I have had a lot of conversations. But you're just thinking and asking things that I haven't had to answer. I haven't had to think about.
I'm glad to hear that.
And it's, you know, what happens is, like, I'm learning something about not just the book, but myself, the whole file cabinet of experiences. I can see it differently.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad that you wanted to take the time, and I'm sorry I made you cry.
You know what? I don't. Yeah, that's not your fault. Because you made me laugh too.
That's true.
And if anything, I'm just grateful to have had a range of an emotional experience, of which crying is part.
Yeah,
and it's not a bad part.
Natasha Trethewey is the author, most recently, of Memorial Drive, A Daughter's Memoir, for which she won the Annisfield Wolf Book Award. She's also published numerous collections of poetry, Monument, Thrall, Beyond Katrina, Native Guard, Bellix, Ophelia, and her debut book called Domestic Work. She's received too many awards, prizes, and fellowships to name, from a Pulitzer to fellowships from both the Rockefeller and the Guggenheim Foundation. And she was named Poet Laureate of the United States for 2 terms. She lives in Chicago with her husband and their dog, and she teaches at Northwestern University. To find out more, check out the Poetry Foundation website. The music in this episode is by Todd Sikafoos, and the excerpt from the audiobook of Memorial Drive you heard courtesy of Echo Harper Audio. I'm Helena de Groot, and this was Poetry Off the Shelf. Thank you for listening.